This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled today to get to visit with Sam Reynolds. Sam is an EY Parthenon, a brilliant person and a good person. He's going to talk to us about what trends he's watching in healthcare currently, as well as where he's most focused and a lot more. Sam, can you take a moment? Tell us about you, yourself, EY Parthenon. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Sure. Yeah, Scott, I've been in healthcare since 2005 when I started a small internship at a company out here in Chicago called Healthcare Futures. They actually got bought up recently by a private equity backed firm. But did that for a while, worked for Deloitte for a while. Then I spent 8 years in industry. My last position was as the corporate strategy director at the American Medical Association. It was probably there where I had what I think it's still to this day probably my biggest career achievement, which was founding this stepsforward.com website, which is a website that folks use, physicians use all over the country to help them run their practices. But after that, I went to Parthenon, where I've been. I'm going on my seventh year now, EY Parthenon, where I focus primarily community providers, academic medicine, and physician practice work. And I've really worked across many functions in those industry areas.
And tell us, it's a daunting time in healthcare. EY Parthenon has got this great brand in healthcare. What are the trends you're watching currently? What's on your mind? What do you see top of mind?
Sure. Yeah. You know, there's a couple of things. The one is the labor shortages and clinician burnout. I mean, this is something that I've been really aware of since I was at the AMA. We spent a lot of time on these topics. You know, a couple of statistics that I just can pull off the top of my head. You know, they surveyed 2,500 nurses in March. One-third of them are saying they're going to quit by the end of 2022. My wife's a nurse, by the way, so I'm acutely aware of how burned out they are. And then, you know, this is something from one of your publications, 7 out of 10 physicians surveyed in 2018 said that they wouldn't recommend the profession of their children. I think those are significant. You know, so this has been going on for a while. You know, who's to blame? You know, how does this affect the culture? And to me, it's the payment system is a big part of this. I mean, COVID exacerbated this, but I think the payment system, especially in primary care, encourages physicians to work in a way that is basically like, you know, like a production line as opposed to a solution shop. And these are words that I take from Dr. Christine Sidsky, who I used to work for. But, you know, physicians aren't feeling like they're working to the top of their license. They've felt like that for a long time. And now I think this has pushed also into the hospitals and acute settings, which, you know, are mostly, you know, you have mostly nurses or your primary employers there. So these point of care professionals are just getting burned out. You know, I think this increase in private equity investment and corporate investment that we're seeing just recently, I don't think it's going to make it worse. I think people think that, but it does make it more complicated. And so, you know, that's something we have to think about. How is that going to work? What do these organizations need to be focused on? I also think the transition of value could make this better because you're going to take out some of this complicated documentation that physicians have to do and nurses as well.
Let me ask you about a couple of things. It's because you've mentioned that, you know, there's people that say that the panacea is the transformation to a value-based care system or a value-based fee system. But isn't it more complicated than that? Because at the end of the day, we've got 330 million Americans, an aging, growing population, a number of physicians not keeping up anywhere near with that pace. And so even if you change the payment system, don't we still just not have a sheer number of doctors that cure the amount of people we have? I mean, is it the real solution, the number of doctors, not the payment system? I guess I hear all the talk about it. And of course, the world became, insurers made so much money during the pandemic by not doing procedures that health systems became very much enamored with the value-based care concept. We'll get capitated but not do anything, which is what insurers did a lot of during the pandemic, meaning no procedures were done, so margins went through the roof. But isn't it more than just transition to value-based care? And, you know, would it really get rid of documentation with the value-based care? You still got to take care of patients and document taking care of patients. So maybe there's a different kind of payment arrangement. But isn't the bigger problem that we don't have enough doctors and physicians and nurses and staffing for the amount of people we're trying to take care of?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I mean, I don't think that's one thing. I mean, I just read an article recently where they're talking about, it was in the Harvard Gazette, where they're talking about how, you know, value-based care has always had all these promises, but it's never really shown on a consistent basis across this country to reduce costs. They haven't figured that out yet. I mean, at the end of the day, you know this, most of the costs in the healthcare system are all these end-of-life costs. And the truth is, the solution to that is cures, right? It's not changing the payment system. But going back to your point about making the medical profession, the point of care medical profession, more attractive to people and essentially being able to recruit more people into the profession and making them happy. I mean, I think that that's going to be a long road. I do think one solution for me is, and the nursing profession has been pushing this for years, is, you know, recruiting people into nursing and, you know, showing them that nursing is a lifelong profession where they can continually get more education and increase their skills and continually be able to work to the top of the license from all the way from being an LPN all the way up to, you know, being a nurse practitioner and being able to see patients. And I think it is pushing, you know, the primary care layer of the physician world into more of a coordinated care role as opposed to a point of service role, and having nurse practitioners essentially, you know, be at the point of service in a primary care base. And go ahead.
Absolutely. And doing more and more at the top of the license versus doing all the janitorial tasks and the other tasks that they've done for so long, right? That are, it's not that they're demeaning. They're just not really what they want to do if they train to be a nurse. It's not that bad or good, but it's not what they prefer to do. And don't blame them. I mean, you talk about your wife's a nurse, so you see this. I talk to more and more nurses who basically say to me, I want to work any place but the inpatient setting. And that to me is fascinating too, because, you know, how do you end up triangulating care and triaging care so you have enough nurses in the inpatient setting, they're doing the things they want to do, not all the things that they've been doing for all these years that they get paid for, but not really what they want to be doing. I mean, how do you sort of change the staffing model so there's enough other staff to take care of the things that the nurses really, you know, so they can practice more at the top of their license? How do we get there? Is that just a full employment problem, or how do we get there too?
Oh, I mean, no, I that's a really good question to ask me, actually. So my wife is getting her PhD, and the topic of her dissertation is how to leverage community colleges across the country to educate the nursing profession and essentially recruit and get people more educated in nursing and to increase the size of the nursing population in this country. And my view is, and I guess I have some inside track on this, is using the education system that we have, especially the community college system, to recruit people that may not even think about. I mean, Scott, you may or may not, I'm sure you know this, but, you know, nursing for many folks that are coming, especially with LPN, I mean, it is a pathway out of poverty for a lot of folks.
No, absolutely. And for a very long time, it also, you know, different communities provided a huge percentage of our nation's nurses, and that has changed, and it's still fantastic people that go into nursing. But how do we get more people to go in nursing? There's 5 million nurses, of which some incredible amount wanted to leave nursing the last couple of years. I think 500,000 to a million, they said, wanted to leave nursing the last couple of years. And that just is daunting. And on the doctor side, there's enough people that want to be doctors. There's just not enough residency spots. I mean, and enough medical, there's enough medical school spots almost, but there's not, they won't admit enough people because there's not enough residency spots. So we've got, you've got enough people that want to go into being a doctor. Just, it's still daunting, but there's not enough residency spots. And then on the nursing side, yes, these pathways to encourage people to become nurses is very much very, very important.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, there's two sides. I mean, there's a job satisfaction side, which you're talking about, which I think, you know, we have to create better work environment, you know, and that's, you know, from an acute center point of view. I think that's what we're talking about now. I mean, I think, you know, the ASC environment, the office environment are good environments. as long as the pay is there. I mean, those are good environments to work in for a lot of folks. I think historically those have been less desirable because they haven't paid as well, you know, and that's certainly changing. But, you know, the other thing you could say, frankly, is that, you know, our system, our health system is becoming less acute focused. You know, we've been seeing this the whole time I've been in the business, and how all this stuff, you know, orthopedics is the latest example, but all these things are going out of the acute center and into the community now, you know, so that essentially creates a system where these more attractive sites of service are going to be more and more prevalent over the years. But I do think, like a lot of things, I think it starts from the ground up. I mean, I think that the more people it's a supply issue. The more people, like you said about the physicians, I think the more people you get into the pipeline, I think the better off we are. Yes, you're going to have people that drop out. You're going to have these waves of disease and things like that, where more people are going to drop out than you would expect. But the way to solve that is just to put more people into the pipeline. And the way to solve that is to, I agree with you, open up the number of residency spots in this country and leverage some of these non-traditional universities that haven't had the ability to grant four-year nursing degrees to enable them to grant those four-year nursing degrees. And I think the one thing I think is really positive, and I know when I was at the AMA, I was not in this group, but I know that they are working on transforming medical education and have been for a while, you know, in making it, you know, in a way more accessible, more modernized. And certainly that's going to necessitate the opening of more residency spots as well. I agree with that.
No, 100%. There was funding it in one of the congressional acts, but it was piled into a lot of other stuff that didn't get passed, but much needed. But this reform of it, as you're talking about, is so, so needed, in my opinion. Talk about, Sam, you touched so many interesting things. What are you most focused on and excited about currently?
Yeah, so it's kind of two things that I'm focused on personally, one EY and then one I'm kind of seeing in the market. These payer-driven partnerships, what I call like pay-viders, so you get payers that are partnering up and helping to build the delivery system, that is very interesting to me. I mean, historically, what we've seen is payers, you know, one of the big ones that everybody knows, essentially going around and buying care delivery assets and not really doing anything with them in particular, just, you know, holding on to them, and really, you could argue, buying them to gain market position in whatever market they want to target after, and they have the money. But I think what we're seeing now is some of the, especially the regional payers, so, you know, state-based payers that have gone out there and bought, you know, a lot of these value-based care assets, and they're then looking to deliver these value-based care assets into market through a delivery system. And to me, that's interesting because the difference between a national payer, a big national payer, and a local state-based payer is that the state-based payer has a lot of investment in these local communities. And it's a lot more investment. Not to say that the big payers don't do, but it's different. We know, to me, healthcare at a macro level, it's all about markets. Every market is different. Every market has different players, different people that control, whether it's hospitals, payers, the employers, you know, in certain places, the government, whatever. You know, so the local payers, the regional payers have a tendency to be able to look at these things and be a little bit maybe more invested in these communities. And as a result of that, they're really looking for a big solution. Say, hey, you know, our innovation team has gone out and bought, you know, all these things that are going to help us, you know, develop a value-based care solution that's actually going to work. Well, we want to also then go out and get some care delivery assets so we can really be integrated. And I can tell you, we have seen the beginnings of this in some places, and in other places, we've really seen this starting to work. And what's interesting to me about this is, you know, historically the payers have gone after everything but the acute centers. They don't want the acute center because essentially in our environment today, it's a cost center. However, we have seen a couple of limited examples of where if the partnerships are structured correctly, they partner with the acute center and then are able to really deliver a regional strategy. That, you know, some of these things are still in their infancy, but, you know, I think this has a lot of legs for me.
But that's fascinating. And certainly this concept of payviders and certainly payers that are providers as well, getting bigger and bigger, particularly when United Healthcare owns Optum, which is one of the biggest providers now in the country. Yep. And yes, also hospitals playing in that game some, but the big payers, Aetna, CVS, United Optum very much in the provider space in a very, very big way. And I think the hospital systems find that quite daunting, really, because they feel like they already had a contentious enough relationship with the payers as it was prior to the payers becoming huge providers as well. So they both were at arm's length with them, but now they feel like they're competing with them too. And very daunting, I think, for many health systems, though, on the flip side of that.
Yeah, I agree. But again, I think if you're, you know, okay, so all these acute, community acute hospitals are trying to crack the value-based care nut. At the end of the day, value-based care is about developing the capabilities of a payer, right? So, and as we've seen, yes, there's been some success stories across the country, but the truth is that most of these acute organizations, healthcare organizations, have not really been able to crack that nut. But what if we get into a joint venture or a partnership? And you know, joint ventures is a lot of what I've done at EY in the last couple of years. What if we get into a partnership where, you know, the payer brings those capabilities, shows us how to use them, and you know, we bring the delivery network. And I've seen it. I think something that's going to start to work. The next thing I want to talk about that I've been working on are these partnerships between providers and AMCs, traditional community providers and AMCs. This is not a new thing. I mean, these are all over the place, and some of them are successful, some of them aren't. But recently, I was able to have a conversation at one of your conferences with an organization that has a they're a national player, longstanding relationship with an academic organization, and it has just gone extremely well. And I just read that the same organization is actually going into another relationship with another academic center. My belief as the demand for acute care continues to decline, I think that a lot of these community providers, in order to meet their needs, especially in terms of recruiting certain, you know, specialty physicians, a lot of different specialties, as we're seeing these organizations get backed by private equity, and really it's very hard for a lot of these community organizations to recruit these guys without an academic, you know, some kind of academic backing. Those relationships are going to become really important. And I think what you're going to see in many of these markets is that the ones that are going to last, the acute organizations that are really going to last long term, are going to have some kind of academic component to them. And again, there's this, the national player that I've seen just do this very well over the last, 10 or so years. So anyway, that's my second one. The one that we're working on as a firm, EY, is, and what we're seeing too is this real investment in social determinants of health. That's to me is very, it's fascinating, that people are, are really interested in this. And we are too. We've got some folks, Dr. Luco, who's pretty well known. He's our chief medical officer. And he has developed a center. We're going after these. I mean, I think the question though about these things is, who is responsible for pushing this agenda? As I was kind of saying, to me, healthcare is all about markets. So if you go into a market, investing in social determinants of health, investing in health equity, it costs money, right? There's upfront money, and it's a long-term investment. But who is to make it? Is it the payers? Is it the providers? I'm mostly a delivery guy. I've done most of my career, as I said, on the care delivery side. What I think the role is for the providers is as a coordinator. Is to figure out how does the government play in, how do local, state, local, state, federal, how do the payers play in, how do the physicians play in, and essentially to coordinate all those bodies to pipeline the folks that really need these services and really need to take advantage of these health equity opportunities to get them pipelined into the system. And there's benefits. The benefit is you get bigger market share. Right, there's brand eminence associated with this stuff, and I think there are really a lot of benefits to it. So to me, it's exciting. We'll see where it goes. I think a lot of people are really unsure what it even means. There's a really good definition on the Robert Wood Johnson website I saw that says health equity means that everyone has a fair and just opportunity to be healthy as possible. This requires removing obstacles to health, such as and they go on. But I think that that's a good definition of it. And again, I think the the providers play a role of kind of coordinating. Then the last one, you know, which I'm sure everybody, you know, is talking about, is this continued interest, and this is the market one, the continued interest in big, you know, in big corporate health. I mean, I think it's great that some of these big players are finally, you know, taking an interest in our business and are trying to invest big money. The other side of that, though, is you have to question, are they going to be successful? And just because they have lots of money and a lot of clout, you know, we've seen these things fail before. What I think makes it complicated, you know, because you could say, well, you know, these they try, why hasn't it worked? And from my perspective, the reason why it hasn't worked historically is, like I said, healthcare is local. And if I am an international company, I'm going to try to apply international you know, at least national standards to every market in this country. You can't do that. You cannot standardize healthcare across this country. It's too market based. And I also think too that, you know, especially on the care delivery side, you know, there's an investment takes a long time to pay off. You know, let's say you're trying to break into some market that's, you know, 50-75% controlled by one payer or health system or something like that. I mean, it takes time to develop these relationships, the physician relationship, all these things that you have to build in order to be successful. And that's one market. And unfortunately, publicly traded companies don't really have the tolerance for that kind of time, historically.
Wait, it's a fascinating discussion. I'm going to touch on one thing you said there. People say, like, for example, that some of these multinational companies, and Amazon comes to mind, have not succeeded in healthcare. They failed in healthcare. Some of those have failed in healthcare. And I would view it somewhat differently. Not so much failures, that some of these huge companies have choices as to where to put capital. And once they get more invested in healthcare, what happens is Amazon is famous for, they take big shots at stuff and then decide what they're really going to double and triple down on. And I think what Amazon has found, at least so far, time and time again, is when they put money into healthcare, they're ultimately not finding the margins they find in things like Amazon Web Services and some other places. And so I don't think I would call it a failure. Though I agree with you fully. I mean, Amazon doesn't have to win in healthcare. If you're a health system or a healthcare company, you have to win in healthcare. So Amazon ultimately chooses, do they keep on allocating capital and people to it or not? And so far, they've chosen it's not as desirable as some of their other businesses. I would contrast that with United, that allocated money into Optum and ultimately decided, look, our Optum business complements our insurance business, and it has margins like an insurance business, but not better than our insurance business. So we end up getting valuations that are improved for United Optum as a whole versus just for United. And Amazon's in a very different business. They've got a technology-driven business, a retail-driven business, an AWS-driven business. They've got these crazy multiples that make healthcare multiples look puny. And so I wouldn't – people try and phrase it as a failure, and I'm not sure I'd look at it that way. I'd say it's constantly evolving choices from some of these big companies versus failures, which are very different things.
Yeah, I mean, valid point. You know,
your point though, that a health system has these built-in sort of like a health system's got to play to its strengths. If I'm gonna, you know, if I have a problem, I want to go to a health system. It's not just great technologically, but one that has lots of great doctors and services and physicians and nurses. And your point on that is right on. What you see is some of these telehealth companies who have seen their multiples destroyed or valuations destroyed. Well, they're destroyed because they're not much deeper than the technology company with a phone. And that's very different than having true depth of knowledge and great coverage and great doctors and physicians. And that's sort of the advantage that health systems have to double down on to stay a winner against these other entrants.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think, though, the future is partnerships. I mean, again, I think you go back to partnerships. I mean, probably two things we're talking about here are partnerships and markets, which I think are both those things are relevant here. I think it's partnerships. I think it's market specific. You know, I think if you go into, you know, a certain like mid-tier market that, you know, is one third or 50% controlled by one health system, and you're financially partnered with that health system in a relationship where both parties have serious skin in the game. And again, we've seen this with payers and acute systems. We've seen this where both parties have skin in the game. They can be successful because, you know, go ahead.
But your point is so well taken. Rather than Amazon trying to do it all themselves with technology and build out a health system, rather than a health system trying to become Amazon technology-wise, you're better off, and that's just an easy example to talk about as Amazon, you're sure. far better off finding ways to partner with these things where you take advantage of each of their great strengths, the consumer and technology, as well as the health system, the physicians, the nurses, everything else, and finding ways to partner versus developing two completely separate ecosystems. I think that's right on. Sam, I've got to let you go. Just we've got to start our next podcast in a moment here at Becker's Healthcare. I want to thank you and EY Parthenon for joining us today. You're one of the nicest, brightest people I get to visit with. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you joining us on the Becker's Healthcare podcast again.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you very much.